Okay, Mertney Davies, interview by Todorovic, December 12, 1985, tape one, side two. Okay.
Another interesting thing was during the, I guess it was the later war years, why Hughes was going to build their flying boat, you remember. And Hughes had been lofting all their aircraft by the old-fashioned shipbuilding ways of laying them out full size on using splines to draw the shape of the contours of the exterior of the aircraft. Well, when they decided to get on have the flying boat, they had no building large enough to lay out these lines full size, and so they did. At that time, the aircraft industry the government had an agreement whereby they could borrow people between companies and on loan. And so I was borrowed and went to Hughes for a while to teach them how to do these lines mathematically so that they didn't have to lay them on full scale.
Okay, so this technique
was very new. The first North American aircraft, for instance, that was lofted this way was the Mustang, that fighter aircraft. Before that, the North American had used, laid them out lines all full size. It was an innovative process, and it was started by Douglas.
And did this new method of doing lofting travel to other companies in the minds of individuals like you who were loaned? Is that the way this new technique was disseminated?
Together with the fact that there were schools going on, night schools. Apollotegi taught schools, and he would teach a class in them. And so people in lofting departments from all over Southern California could take classes in them. And I do not know when this method was moved to, say, Lockheed or Convair in San Diego or Volte out at Downey. But I assume that, it moved throughout the industry.
And it did so fairly rapidly within a couple of years?
I think so. Because we went, for instance, down. Wayne White and I would go down to Douglas Long Beach plant and set up a little group there to do similar things. And we would, we had an internal bus system at Douglas, which would move from one plant to another. And so we would just be riding the buses on occasions if they had any problems or to help out at different plants. This was part of the job.
Mm-hmm. Okay, to then return to the 558.
My memory isn't real sharp on details because it did seem like at the time it was a relatively small and easy job. It was not a complex shape because aerodynamically. And
for supersonic velocities, the density of the medium, or effective density of the medium at that point is such that you can't have any real...
That's right. You do not have any clever bulges, and you're not carrying armament, and you're not folding wings. It was a relatively smooth and clean aircraft. And so from this point of view, it was... It wasn't such a large job. It was also small compared to the large aircraft, either the transports that were being built at Long Beach or the bombers which were being built at El Segundo for the Navy. As a matter of fact, the turbojet, the Phase 1, was a little bit more difficult than the Phase 2, but both of them, from my point of view, were my part of the job was fairly simple. I did help a little bit with the aerodynamic calculations because, as I say, we probably had the best computing group at Douglas at the time, We didn't have computers in the sense that we have today, remember. We were working with small hand machines.
Friedens?
Yes, Frieden mainly? And Marchand. And in fact, within our groups, why, you know, individuals would have their pet machines that would be like your pet brands of automobiles or pet cigarettes or pet anything else that people have as hobbies, and, hi-fi sets or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or now our pet computers, you know, they like the IBM or some other brand a little better.
Were you aware of automated computing initiatives that
not
were,
at
that
this
were going
time.
On at
I was
time.
At RAND. When I moved to RAND, we had we soon got one of the von Neumann machines, and we had a whole department that was interested in computing in the very early 50s, early 40s. Von Neumann, I believe, he was at RAND a number of times, and I can't remember what his formal relationship was with RAND, but the people there were very well aware of him, and I think he might have been on a board of trustees or something of this sort at RAND.
Okay.
And we had the second machine that he built. I can't remember what they called it at that time. You might remember, but it was a machine with tubes, and it was there was one at Princeton, I believe, and this was the second one in the country. And RAND had by far the best computing facilities in the West Coast at that time.
I will probably want to get back to you with some more questions about the computing group and about this technique of lofting after I've talked with our curator of computers here, who's now working on a gallery and also working on some research on the electronic computing and the aerospace industry, the influence of one of each upon the other, and so forth. But let me just ask you: you didn't join RAND until a couple of years after it had been going, more or less. Let me just ask you: how did you first hear about Project RAND?
Well, I think Project RAND started in 46, and I joined in 47.
Oh,
so
okay.
So it wasn't, RAND had, the Project RAND had started earlier, but it was, took a little time before I heard about it at El Segundo. It started at Santa Monica, and it was just word of mouth that I heard about it. It was not, there were no formal announcements. As a matter of fact, I think that there was probably a desire to keep it pretty quiet at the time. The first report was on the Earth Circling Spaceship. It was published in 46, and it was done very quickly. I think it was less than 3 months or something, the whole study. And I think that this early history was has been reviewed by Cargo Hall in great detail, including the Navy studies at that time, and I guess the competition between the Navy and the Air Force was
yes.
reviewed by him in great detail. Now, at the level that I was working, I was not aware of all of the, you know, the political game which was being played out
mm-hmm.
between services and things. I was interested, of course, in the technical matters, and I did not know just what sort of a role I might play at RAND. I should back up and mention that during the war years, that was when I built my first telescope.
Okay, well then let's back up to that, because we've talked about your experience in modeling shapes mathematically, and the obvious thing is, knowing what you got involved in later, the obvious question is, when did you first start to fool around with optics, and that sort of thing. So your interest in astronomy, we go back and...
Well, of course, I was always interested more or less in astronomy, and in, you know, in the 30s I was interested like in the ability to in going to other planets, but during that period it was frustrating because I didn't see any opportunities to actually participate in this. Now, I did get to, as I mentioned, my colleague at Douglas, Wayne White, and he was married and had a small child. And during that period he had a second child. I was not married, and he was a major in chemistry at Caltech. Of course, had a good mathematical background, and so we communicated very well. And I talking to him about astronomy, and we said, well, let's build telescopes, and so. He at his house, I would go over there, and we each ground a 4-inch mirror to start with, decided to start with something simple and learn how to grind mirrors and shapes. And we started with 4-inch so we could do it in a fairly short period of time. We wanted to try to make telescopes quickly was the object.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know anything about it. But
how did you find out how to do that? What?
We got this little book about amateur telescope making, and all the instructions were there, and sent away for blank and the various kinds of grinding materials and polishing materials, and tried it out.
Okay,
it
so was, this is the classic
and
book.
That's right.
Amateur
it was the
telescope.
Classified. It was a classical book at that time. I assume there are newer ones now, but at that time there was just one, and it was the book.
Okay.
We followed instructions, and he had a house, and his wife put up with us in her kitchen, you know, where you melded tar in the oven and, you know, did the laps and all that stuff.
Nothing has changed. I'd say the people are still using the same book. They are still messing up their kitchens and taking the wrath of family members.
Right. That's I believe, and that was exactly what was going on. And he lived in Sherman Oaks across the hill, and I lived in Santa Monica, so I had to drive across the mountain to the valley to work on this telescope at night. And so we each had our 4-inch telescope, and I decided to go into and build an 8-inch. Wayne didn't decide to. And but I didn't have any place really to do it. So another friend, Don Clark, who lived in Santa Monica, was living with his parents. And I talked to him about it, and he became interested. And we built a machine which would do the automatic grinding using a motor drive.
Really?
And set up, you know, the Foucault testing and all the rest of this stuff. And so we proceeded, and over the period of time to grind this 8-inch piece of glass. It was during this period that I was started dating, who was to become my wife. And she was, you know, typical young girl. And She still laughs at the fact that I asked her out for a date and took her over to grind telescope mirrors to teach her how a Foucault, what a Foucault test was. And she thought that was the strangest kind of a date she'd ever been asked for. But I was in the middle of grinding the telescope and didn't want to waste time going to movies or something.
It's like George Ellery Hale visiting Lick on his honeymoon.
Yeah. Oh, don't ask her about our honeymoon. That was, to this day, that was funny. My mother had told me when I was young, when she went on her honeymoon, it was, you know, they didn't have anything planned except to go on a trip, and they didn't know what to do all day long. They'd taken vacation, like. So I decided when I went on my honeymoon, I wasn't going to have any dull time. And so I arranged to drive to La Jolla. And there I had it scheduled every day. we drove to Palomar one day. We went to the San Diego Zoo in a... We played tennis, we went to the beach, we had every day scheduled. Anyway, that's
fantastic. So your first date...
first date, but it was one of our early dates.
You're grinding
mirrors. We were grinding telescopes. And she, of course, hadn't any technical background at all, and she didn't know what was going on, why anybody would be interested in Foucault tests of little ends.
Someday the wives of astronomers are going to get together and compare notes.
Yeah, they all seem to have some pretty strange experiences I've found.
I'm curious about this grinding machine. Was this something of your own invention? Did you follow plans in a book? Did you follow plans and improve upon it, or...
Well, I don't remember much about it. I think that we had, we had some schemes that were illustrated in books, and we really just put it together by, you know, with 2x4s, and we were familiar, of course, from doing it by hand, what kinds of actions were necessary, and I think we had some plans were described in the books. I don't think that it was anything innovative. We did, you know, we had a, for instance, as you move back and forth, you want to rotate the mirror, and so we had a ratchet device, and we had friends at Douglas make the ratchet wheel, so that as it moves back and forth, a piece hit the gear and rotated as it went back and forth. And, you know, we had the compound actions that way built into it. But I don't remember if those came out of the book or whether, you know, we just sort of improvised them. I don't think that it was anything innovative. I think that I learned a great deal because, you know, later on I was involved with places like ITEC where they were, this is when I, you know, really, I'd taken optics at college, but I was not particularly, it didn't seem anything particularly interesting. At this period, I really became interested in optics and, you know, learned the theories and the, what you worry about in lens design and that kind of sort of thing. So later in my life, when I was working with Jim Baker and some of these top optical designers, I was leaning upon this period of my education to learn how to communicate.
Okay.
That's not that I was any optical designer. I never was, but you have to know a little bit to be able to communicate with designers and, you know, and that sort of thing. And even to now, I work with optical people at JPL.
Mm-hmm, sure. So you ground this 8-inch, and what did you do with that?
Well, I never did very much with it, as a matter of fact, because after we got married, and I never built a mount really for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it soon got into problem mechanical design and mechanical problems, which as I was never involved with a machine shop myself, and so as a practical matter, I never did anything with it. I did have it set up on a 2x4 so that at night I could use it by hand, and that was as a Newtonian. And this was the only mount that I ever did have. I always had thoughts about getting a decent mount for it, but I just never did.
Mm-hmm. So, and the 6-inch?
The 4-inch.
The 4-inch that you...
I don't even remember what happened to it. But I lost interest in it. I had it mounted on a tube from linoleum. You find that linoleum comes rolled up on a cardboard tube, and the tube fits a 4-inch perfectly.
Uh-huh.
And so I had it mounted, used that as an Newtonian configuration. But I didn't have a tracking mount. And so, really, I didn't do anything with that either.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter, I've really never worked with a telescope, even to this day. And I would, it's one of those things that I would like to do, and I always think that I'll go to the mountain with one of my colleagues and play with a telescope, but I still have that to do. I've never done that.
So, you spend a fair amount of time making these instruments, but you did not do a great deal of observing.
That's right.
And what was your
in
knowledge?
In principle, I thought I was interested in observing, and by the time I was, it took so much energy to make them that I lost my enthusiasm by the time. You know, I could get them into. I always saw that it was. I was still a long ways from observing, and I just never got around to actually making any sensible use for them.
Did you have much knowledge of the visible sky, constellations? Did you spend much time looking at the sky?
No, I didn't. And I took at Stanford, we had an astronomy class. And at that time, I learned the names of some of the principal stars. And we had to learn the constellations and how to find them and this sort of thing. But I really did not. And even today, I find I've never spent much time with the stars. My real interest was always in planets, things that were closer to us, in ability to go there. I always felt that, you know, I'd really like to visit those places.
Mm-hmm.
And I never quite gave up that dream, I think. You kind of run out of time, and you realize that, but it's, you still have a dream, and these things are what keep you going and what you keep your interest up.
Did you have any friends or colleagues at the time who were either observing or shared this interest?
Well, not very many. I didn't know any professional astronomers at that time. Wayne White was the closest thing, and he didn't know really any more than I did about it. It was just an exploratory thing. We had there was another fellow named Vern Hamilton, who was at Douglas. He was, I believe, in engineering checker during World War II, and he was interested in optics, and he was very innovative optical designer, just but a very practical kind of designer. He didn't have any formal education in that field, but he was interested in mechanical design, and he would put together optical devices with shoestrings, essentially. He just would never. He was always interested in doing it cleverly without much expense. And I lost touch with him, although I did see him once in about 1960. And he was still doing the similar things. And I think he did design at Douglas. He got into the optical design later on and in that kind of work for Douglas in the 60s or so.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost touch with him.
Okay. Let's check the about okay. this. We're continuing now discussing the difference telescope makers versus telescope users.
This became apparent to me that I was not really interested in telescope making. What I was interested in were the bodies which, like the Moon or Mars, which to me were fascinating bodies that I wanted to learn more about. And I realized that the telescope making was going to just take such a tremendous effort, and it was not something that I was good at. I found I didn't have a machine shop. I wasn't handy with making and even designing these clever little devices. And so I found that where I was really going to be more interesting was in the spacecraft, and the to work with the spacecraft which could explore these things. And this occurred again when I was this is why I went to RAND, because RAND was working on satellite design at the time. And that was the same period that I was working on this 8-inch telescope. And so it became clear to me that the spacecraft were much more exciting than trying to work with the Earth-based telescopes. And I knew right then that where I wanted to go was going to be with a spacecraft.
So when your early knowledge of RAND before you actually joined, you were aware that they were working on satellites already at that time?
That's right. This is what I heard. And as soon as I heard that, I said, that's where I want to be. And it was that quick. There are a few times in my life that I made decisions. Another time came later when I was asked if I wanted to go to Antarctica. I said yes, and I told my wife, and she said, well, when do you go? And I said, well, I don't know, I didn't ask. And she said, well, how long do you stay? And I said, well, I don't know, I didn't ask. You know, there are a few times that you can make a decision without knowing any more about it, and and that was the way it was when I heard about RAND, and there was no doubt or question that that was where I wanted to be. And by my problem then was to want for Rand to want me, with my background and capabilities and all. I was so that was when I, Wayne White and I both transferred over to Rand.
How did you, what did you do? Did you go up to Santa Monica and look for the Rand Project office and put?
Rand was, no, not exactly, but approximately. Rand, I learned a little bit about Rand, that enough to know that Rand is broken into departments or divisions. They had an aircraft division that was headed by Gene Root. They had missiles, which was headed by Jimmy Lipp, and had mathematics, which was John Williams, and I can't remember all. I think they had a political science department, and maybe not at that time. Maybe that came later. At any rate, I talked to Jimmy Lipp because he headed the missile division, and this was where the satellite work was going on. And he said, okay. And so I went to work and was put under structural design under George Clement, which was, you know, a little group under him, working for Jimmy Lipp.
Okay, that's a pretty obvious place, given what you had been doing, to go into structural design. And this was structural design of the launch vehicles, or structural design of the spacecraft
both,
that were under consideration?
Both at that time.
Okay.
Rand was working on feasibility of satellites.
Mm-hmm.
And the first report came out and said they're feasible. It's feasible. There was a second report that went into some different design configurations, and that had just been finished when I came to Rand. In other words, it was a little bit, it was basically a second look at the feasibility. And then the next study, part of the study program, was utility and cost.
Okay, so world-circling spaceship is the feasibility.
That was the first feasibility
study. Feasibility study.
And there was a second feasibility study, which was more comprehensive in detail. And this was performed by the original study was performed by just ad hoc groups. They Douglas pulled together a dozen people to make that study and to do it in a very brief time.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Rand project became a little bit more stable at Rand, or at Douglas.
Yeah.
They got a contract for an extended period of time, not just to make one study. And so then they set up an organization, which was headed by Frank Kolbaum. Goldie was his deputy, and they had various departments or divisions and had heads of these. And then this second feasibility study was made by that organization. It was a typical aircraft industry kind of organization.
Okay, and the second feasibility study, what was the title of that, if you can recall? Or was this a revised edition of?
No, it was. I can't remember the title, but it was broken down into sections. It was much more detailed. There was a structural section of the design, aerodynamic section, studies of fuels. Went through, this is where Wayne White was a chemist and got into the study of all kinds of propellants. They were studying the computing specific impulses of different propellants. For instance, that study ended up with hydrazine oxygen as propellants in a three-stage configuration. But, you know, you'd study hydrazine and fluorine and all these propellant combinations is what Wayne White was doing.
Okay.
Under Joe Krieger. This is a whole organization and had a group on flight mechanics.
Mm-hmm. So you, when you joined RAND, were you given the 46 study to read, or had you already become aware of that?
I didn't read that. No, I read the 47 study, which was this
that was
much
done
more
when
comprehensive.
You joined.
It was done, mm-hmm. just finished by the time I got there. Mm-hmm. I was sorry that I had not been there in time to participate in it, but that was the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the interest turned to utilities, and there were studies started of delivery systems, essentially based on rocket capabilities, as well as satellite studies of utility of satellites, mm-hmm. and costs.
Okay, we're getting to the end of our time here, and I think this is an appropriate place to break off, because next time we can pick up with RAND.
Okay.
I thank you very much for your time and for answering these questions.
Well.
This is the end of tape one, side two, one tape only this session.